Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Geek Town Radio. It's a special edition this week based around horror. So one of the reasons we're doing a special this week is because I'm away on Monday doing some other stuff. So I had a couple of interviews which I thought would work quite well together as a special, and they're both really appropriate for this week. Coming up later in the show, we've got an interview with the supervising sound editors of A Quiet Place, which is the movie that's out at the moment, which has been getting amazing reviews. But before that, we're going to talk to Aaron Martin, who is the series creator of the horror anthology series Slasher. The show is due to return for its second season, titled Slasher Guilty Party, on Pick TV from Tuesday, the 1st of May at 10 p.m. It's inspired by those 80s and 90s slasher movies. It's every inch a teen slasher fest with some incredibly violent deaths in it. I've seen the first episode. It's immense fun. We chat a bit with Aaron on the phone to talk about the show and his inspiration behind it. So here's the interview with Aaron. We'll see you afterwards for the Quiet Place interview. Hi, Aaron. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. So you're based up in Canada, I take it?
I am. I am in Canada.
Is that where you shoot the show as well?
Yeah, we shoot it. Season one, we shot in Northern Ontario. And then season two, we shot like an hour north of Toronto.
Yes. Yeah. It's useful, that sort of area. There seems to be a lot of, like, you know, an hour from a beach, an hour from like a snowy hilltop, you know, an hour from woodlands, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. You get a lot of different looks not far from Toronto, which is good. Except, of course, you know, the seasons impact that, but season two was a snowy season, so it was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. We should say the show you're on to talk about is Slasher, the Guilty Party, which is the second season of
right.
Slasher. Comes on to Pick TV over here on May the 1st. I think everywhere else in the world it's on Netflix, but it's on Pick TV over here.
Yeah, I think there's some territories that aren't Netflix, or at least Netflix doesn't get the first window, but yeah, definitely UK is on Pick TV.
So do you want to just explain a little bit about what we're going to see in the second season?
Sure. So season two, I mean, it's right in the title. It's very much about guilt. That's why it's called Guilty Party. It's about a bunch of friends who were at a summer camp who did something really terrible and have come back 5 years later to bury the evidence that someone is not going to let them. So like season one, there's going to be, you know, one or more kills every episode. And it's not just a slasher show. It's also a murder mystery. So by the end of the season, you will know who did what and who's doing what.
Yeah. I have watched the first episode. I missed the first season, I'm sorry to say. I don't immediately go for horror shows usually, or sort of, you know, shows with kind of gore in. But I have seen the first episode because they sent me it for the interview of season two. I really enjoyed it. It was it's got that sort of feel of those sort of slasher movies, you know. So yeah. I really, really enjoyed that episode. There is a particularly gory death in that first episode as well.
Yeah, just a bit. You know, it gets worse though, or better depending on how you feel about it. We upped the kills definitely from season one to season two, and it's not like the whole. I mean, most of the show actually isn't that. Most of the show is a character drama and a murder mystery with punctuations of really disturbing murders.
Yeah, I could see that definitely. The murders are fairly disturbing. You talk about it being a murder mystery. I have to say, watching it, one of the shows that came to mind was How to Get Away with Murder, in the sort of structure of really not knowing exactly what's going on right at the beginning, and you sort of more is revealed as you kind of go through the season, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that's a sort of conscious way of you know, you want to kind of use that to tease the audience out.
Yeah, I mean, like the difference between doing a slasher series and a slasher movie is, in a slasher movie, you have 120 minutes maximum to just do a bunch of carnage, but we've got 8 hours, and you can't spend 8 hours of just killing people, because that would be repetitive and boring. So, and for me, like the reason that I like this genre is because I'm a big fan of Agatha Christie, and she basically wrote the first slasher film, and I guess it was a novel, but and then There Were None, which was, you know, a bunch of people on an island stranded who get killed one by one for something they did in the past. And that was as much of an inspiration for me with slasher as the slasher movies I grew up on in the 80s.
Yeah, that makes sense. You can see it coming through, certainly. The cast for this season, you've got some people coming back from season one, but it's an anthology series, so they're in different roles. You've also added a few new people, a few familiar faces like Leslie Hope, which people will know as Terry Bauer from 24, yeah. And Ty Olson, who was Benny in Supernatural, and a few other people as well. So how did you get the cast together for the obviously you knew some of them. How did you get the new people in?
Well, it's a broad combination of the great thing about doing an 8-part anthology show that we actually block shoot. So we shoot all 8 at the same time. And that means that we can get people like Leslie Hope, we can get people like Ty Olson, and they can fit in, you know, a couple weeks in between their other busy schedules. So it's actually really amazing that there are a lot of Canadian actors who we probably wouldn't get if we had to have them year after year, but we can get because the way we shoot it. And so that's how we got some of the bigger names in the show. But it's also a combination of people that I've worked with, not just on this show, but on other series. So Paula Brancati, who plays Dawn, is an actress I worked with on a show called Being Erica.
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, it's such a small community in Canada. You basically know everybody. And I worked on Degrassi, the Next Generation. I did its first 4 seasons. And there are so many actors that have come out of that I keep working with as they age and they can take on different roles. So it's actually a great thing with this show, because again, it's such a small specific window of time we shoot it that we can bring in lots of people.
Yeah, that's, and you need a high turnover of cast, I guess, if you're killing people off quite a lot of the time.
Yeah. you need a few people. And then there was just, you know, I just like working with actors who I worked with before, because you get to know them really well, and it's fun to see them play different parts. It's like Paula Brancati, for going back to her, she played a completely different character on Being Erica, the nice, fun, happy friend. And now she's playing a very mean, horrible person. And it's fun to see someone who's as nice in real life as Paula is stretch herself that way.
Yeah, definitely. You've got this interesting setup this time around with the kind of two groups, because you've got the kids that are coming back up to this place where they used to have this summer camp, which is now being turned into this kind of spiritual retreat. So you've got this bunch of people that are sort of the spiritual kind of hippie sort of guys, and then these people that are coming up to try and cover up this thing that they did. So do you want to just talk a little bit about the juxtaposition between those two groups?
Yeah, I mean, it's unlike season one, which was set in a small town and everybody was a potential victim or killer. This season's really isolated. It takes place over 3 or 4 days, and we really needed an us versus them kind of feel for the show. And I just like the idea of a bunch of new age hippies, you know, facing the fact that there might be a killer among them, or they might have just opened their doors to a killer, and also seeing what secrets those people have and what they've escaped from, like why they've secluded themselves in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, there does seem to be some interesting stories going to come out of that from what I saw in that first episode.
Yeah.
Where did the story idea come from? Have you got any experience of sort of summer camps and those sort of retreat places? Because summer camps are something we don't really do in the UK, but obviously are quite aware of because of the American movies and that sort of stuff. So
yeah, you know, it's funny because actually I find the woods terrifying just in general. Like I'm a weird Canadian that I never went to summer camp. Most everybody else did. Where I grew up, it wasn't like this northern feel that the show has. I grew up in like the very south of southern Ontario, so we would go down to Lake Erie, which is not the same thing at all.
Yeah.
So I don't like the woods. I don't like the outside, and it terrifies me in itself. So it just kind of felt like a perfect setting for this, especially with the weather of winter and the fact that you can't just, you know, hail a taxi or an Uber and save yourself. You're stuck there.
Yeah. Those sort of isolated settings seem to work very well for these sort of horror genre things.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, the thing is like, you don't want the audience to be going, why don't they just leave?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I was being, you know, hunted down, I would probably not stay if I could.
Yes. Very true. You created the series and have you written all the episodes as well?
Season one, I wrote all the episodes, but season two, I had a bunch of freelance writers who wrote. So I wrote the first and the last one, and then each other one, all the other six were written by different writers.
Are you on set most of the time as well, or is it sort of just handed off to a director and left to it?
We do an interesting, because we're shooting all eight at once, we have only one director. And in season one, I was on set the whole time because we were up in a city called Sudbury, which is about probably a 6-hour drive from Toronto. And so we were all camped up there. But season two, I wasn't on set every day. It just didn't make sense for me to be there. And what I would do is, you know, hand in hand with the director, go through the tone of every scene. And just, it was very much a partnership between me and Felipe, who directed all eight. And I let him and the production and one of our producers, Jay Bennett, be up there and run the show while I was sort of like an outside brain watching what was going on, and I could, you know, remind them of things and keep them on track that way.
And the fact, of course, that this is set in the woods, in the cold, had no bearing on the fact that you didn't wear a set every day.
Had nothing to do with it.
I was going to say, if you have to be on set every day, you write shows that are set on a beach in the sun.
I know. I keep saying, like, if we get a season three, I want it to be in Hawaii.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's what you want to do.
Yeah,
I'm assuming you've always been a fan of this sort of horror slasher drama. What sort of movies did you grow up on in this sort of area?
You know, I was a teenager in the 80s, so I just remember us, you know, me and my friends, we'd always get together and terrify ourselves watching movies like Friday the 13th or Halloween or Sleepaway Camp. Like, there was, the 80s had this, you know, slew of ridiculous slasher films that,
yeah,
you know, probably if you look back, aren't that great, but they were very effective. And so it's kind of, season one especially was kind of a love letter to all those really iconic films. So season two, it actually, the films are probably Friday the 13th and I Know What You Did Last Summer that were the two most influential for what the storyline is.
Yeah, I can see certainly influence of those in that, definitely. I went through when my dad used to run a video business. So I it was one of those things that you had obviously the top sort of brand things like Ghost was a big movie at the time and that sort of stuff, but a lot of the kind of filler movies were anything from, you know, Critters and all the trauma films and all that. So I've seen a ridiculous amount of those sort of low budget slasher movies over the years, but they're great fun. Those 80s ones are brilliant.
And there's something kind of charming in a weird way about them that, to me, something like torture porn kind of films, I just can't watch. Like the Hostels of the world, those kind of movies, just they're just so disturbing that I can't watch them. Whereas I can watch an old slasher film because they're kind kind of funny.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I very much am. I think that's probably the thing that turned me off a lot of the modern horror. And because, as I said earlier, I don't watch that much horror. And I think it's that torture porn stuff. Whereas this is far more in that tradition of the kind of classic 80s sort of slasher, which is far more my sort of thing. So, you know, definitely enjoy that a lot more. If I give you a couple more general questions, what's the best piece of advice somebody's given you?
So pertaining to the job, Linda Schuyler, she basically created Degrassi, the whole Degrassi franchise, and she was my first boss in television. And she said to me that as a boss, what you always have to do is, even if you don't know the answer, give people an answer, because that's what people that are looking up to you in your leadership position need. So that's something that is always stuck with me. And then an early mentor, what really stuck with me that he said was that you can work in this industry in a competitive way, or you can work in this industry in a way that you maintain friendships, and that ultimately will be better for you, which is so true.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I can see that. What's been the most interesting experience you've had whilst working so far?
There were some, because Degrassi had such a big fan base of not even necessarily teenagers. So I got to work with Kevin Smith, his first assistant director. So that, that was one. Obviously Drake was a guy that we cast back in before he was Drake, the singer. So that's been interesting watching his career, take off. And then of all people, Billy Ray Cyrus was on an episode of Degrassi and he played a limo driver. So that was, I don't know why, but that happened and it was interesting. So, I guess each show's kind of different. On Slasher, it's just the fun of, horror is really scary to watch, but when you're actually shooting it, it's really fun. Which sounds weird, but it's, you're doing ridiculous stuff. We in season one, we had an actor named Jefferson Brown have to lay in this ditch we dug, and we dropped live snakes on him for an hour. why are we getting paid for this? It's very weird. So that was probably, that was a highlight.
Yeah, that constitutes interesting, I think, certainly.
Yeah, I got paid to drop snakes on someone, okay.
Brilliant. You mentioned there working with Kevin Smith. I am a huge, huge Kevin Smith fan, and I know what a massive fan he was of Degrassi as well. So
yeah, he knew more about Degrassi than I did, and I was like, I've been doing this for 4 years, but he's so smart. He's got this brain that remembers everything. And such a nice guy. And thank God he seems to be doing better after his heart attack.
Yeah. I was incredibly relieved to hear that he's doing okay and seems to be kind of back out there and doing podcasts again and stuff. So I'm very happy that he's well. What career would you be doing if you weren't doing this, do you think?
Oh my God, I don't know. I can't imagine. I don't know. I've never thought of that. That's why I'm doing this. I don't know. I wouldn't want to be working in an office, and I wouldn't want to be a teacher. Maybe a lawyer, because I can argue. I don't know.
Interesting being a lawyer and then in an alternative reality are making these sort of slasher movies. That's kind of interesting juxtaposition. A couple of final questions that we always ask people, because obviously we cover a lot of TV shows. So first question would be, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
What am I watching at the moment? I just finished Babylon Berlin, which I loved, the German show.
Right.
Really excited for The Americans to be coming back, which is my favorite show on TV.
That's a great series.
It's so good. And it's the last season, which makes me sad. What else am I watching right now? It's kind of weird because I don't watch things as they air necessarily anymore. I can tell you what shows I love. I love Search Party, which is a great comedy. I think those are the ones that stick out to me right now.
They've just released a mini trailer for Night Flyers, this new thing based on the George R.R. Martin, which might be up your street. Given that you worked on Killjoys a bit and you're on Slasher, that's sort of a horror sci-fi mix. So that might be worth checking out.
Okay, I will check that out for sure.
If you had the opportunity to work on any show, past, present, or future, other than the ones you've been involved with, obviously, which show would it be?
I can tell you there would be two shows. There's three shows. I'm going to give you three. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for sure.
Yes.
Rome, which is one of my favorite shows.
I love that.
Mad Men is also one of my favorite shows.
Good collection. Good collection of shows. I adored Rome. I was so gutted when they didn't make more of that.
It was too ahead of its time, right? It was, if it had come out 5 years later, it would have done exceedingly well.
Yeah, yeah. And huge Buffy fan, obviously. that would be a great show for you to be involved with, I'm sure. There have been rumors of them bringing it back at some point, although only if Joss agrees. So, you know, maybe you can.
I want them to leave it as it was. Just let it go. I'm sick of all these reboots.
Yeah, you see, there was one that they did in comic book form, which was a vampire slayer set called Frey. Vampire slayer, but set in a future.
Mm-hmm.
Which the comic books for that are great. I always thought that would make a great TV series if they wanted to do something within the Buffyverse, but, you know, new.
Yeah.
That would be a good way of going, I think. But anyway, yeah. We'll see. Thank you for spending a bit of time talking. I shall let you get back to it. Looking forward to seeing the rest of it when it comes onto TV.
Yeah. I hope you can stomach the murder scenes. There's a lot in between that you don't have to hide your eyes for.
Yeah, I will be carrying on watching it. I did really enjoy the first episode. Okay. So, looking forward to it. Brilliant. Okay. Cheers. Thanks for that.
Yeah, thanks for talking. Bye.
No problem. Bye. So that was the interview with Aaron Martin, the creator of Slasher Guilty Party, which you can see on Pick TV from Tuesday, the 1st of May at 10 p.m. The next interview we have is with Ethan Van Rye and Eric Amdahl, who are the supervising sound editors of A Quiet Place, which is in UK cinemas right now. Because of the premise of John Krasinski and Emily Blunt's debut horror film, A Quiet Place, if they hear you, they hunt you. Ethan and Eric's jobs were crucial in immersing the audience into the movie. The lack of dialogue in the film makes the sound a very integral part of building the suspense and amplifying the terror. We chat to them about challenges working on the film, working with the composer Marco Beltrami, and what their job entails. Just a bit of background on the two guys. Together, Ethan and Eric have garnered 7 Oscar nominations and 2 wins for King Kong and Lord of the Rings: The Two Towers. They're also responsible for the sound design and sound editing of the Transformers movies, including the upcoming Bumblebee film. They've worked on Argo, Godzilla, the Kung Fu Panda films, a whole bunch of other movies that we'll talk about as well when we get into the interview. Here's the interview with these guys. I hope you really enjoy it. We'll see you afterwards for some highlights for next week on TV.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Hello.
How you doing?
Good. How's it going?
Not too bad, thanks. It's very nice to have you come on and talk about your work, particularly the latest film, obviously. You're actually the second sound designers we've had on. The first one was Julian Slater, who a week after on the show went on to be nominated for an Oscar. So, you know, no pressure.
No pressure at all. Yeah, no, we know Julian well. He's a great guy.
Yeah, lovely guy. He was robbed of that Oscar, if you ask me, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, no, it happens, though. We've been robbed a few times as well.
yeah, no, I'm sure.
We're not biased at all.
Yeah. I thought how anybody can vote anything other than Baby Driver for an Oscar for winning that was beyond.
Yeah, it was a spectacular example of sound being part of the DNA of the filmmaking.
Yeah, totally. Just in case anybody didn't hear the last time we had a sound designer on, do you want to just explain what your job entails?
Yeah, so our job, both Ethan and I are supervising sound editors. So our job is to really be the artistic and creative guides to the entire sound crew, which includes sound effects editors, sound designer, Dialogue ADR team, Foley team, and we kind of shepherd and corral the team together into a shared sonic artistic vision, and then shepherd the experience and work with the filmmakers to create, you know, what we consider to be 50% of the cinematic experience, which is everything you hear, except for the music, of course.
Yes.
So we do influence how music is played and where it's played. And obviously, in a quiet place, that's very important.
Yes, of course. And,
just to add one detail to what Eric's description, which is great and pretty complete, but just the mix process, you know, which we also kind of supervise, because the way we work these days is basically we're mixing kind of, we're essentially temp mixing the whole time we're working all the way, and then that sort of just evolves into the final mix, which is just really the final sort of piece of the sound puzzle that comes together. And so we supervise, you know, that part as well.
Right. Yeah. That I think is a fairly good description. That works for me. So how did each of you actually get into sound design in the first place?
Well, this is Eric. I'll start. I suppose I kind of started getting into sound as a kid. I mean, maybe first starting with playing the piano when I was five years old and coming up with my own compositions. And it was something that I just really gravitated towards. And my father was kind of a hobbyist photographer and had a Super 8 millimeter camera and gave that to me. And I started making my own silent films until I got my first video camera, Hi-8 camera, and then I actually started working with sound, and I converted my parents' dining room into a little editing and mixing suite. So nice. I had, at the time, I thought it was like an incredibly advanced Audio Technica 8-channel mixer. Like, wow, 8 channels. and of course, no automation. This is analog days. So, yeah. You know, kind of mixing on the fly. And if you make a mistake, you have to roll all the way back and start over. And so, yeah, so I'd make my own movies and my own soundtracks, and then wound up going to college. And originally, I was just going to study biology and do pre-med. And at the last minute, I decided I wanted to double major and do film studies as well. And so I went to University of Southern California, which has a fantastic film school.
Yeah.
And by my third year, decided it was just too much doing both pre-med and film. So I decided to focus exclusively on film. And as a side job, worked in the sound department there at the film school. And one of my teachers was Tom Holman, who's the inventor of THX. So I had a lot of great influences there. And I supervised the Spielberg scoring stage. So I'd record music scores there, and just kind of fell in love with sound. And such a strong community of great people. Fortunately, I got a job offer right out of film school as an assistant sound editor on a television show called NYPD Blue. And then a year after that, I started doing effects editing, and then slowly got into feature films, and then started supervising, and then it was in 2006, Ethan and I had our first collaboration together on the first Transformers film, and have been partners ever since.
Yeah, awesome. So, Ethan, what about you?
Okay, so I also actually started early making my own little Super 8 films in high school. And then after I really loved the sort of the process of going out into the world and capturing, you know, moments as they happen on film and sound, and sort of loved that whole experience. And then after high school, I too was going into the sciences. I started studying hydrology and geology. And then I, at the end of my first year of doing that, I got in a really bad car accident and was kind of lucky to live through it.
Wow.
It reoriented my sort of priorities, made me really, it was like one of those wake-up calls, making me realize, man, life is tenuous And I just maybe need to be doing what I really love to do. And what I really want to do is get into filmmaking. So I switched universities, started going to film school. And when I got out of film school, it was in the, I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is a little hub of film sound. And I got an apprentice position in sound editing at Skywalker Sound, which at that time was George Lucas's sound facility. Yeah. Film sound facility. So I started working as an apprentice, and within before too long, I was working on Francis Coppola's Godfather, and then I went on to work as an effects assistant on Terminator 2, which Gary Rydstrom was the sound designer on, and he became sort of a mentor towards me. I spent close to a year working on that film, doing a lot of sound effects recording, field recording, mostly of vehicles. And it really reminded me of what inspired me to get into filmmaking in the first place, because I was able to get out into the world and capture things as they were happening and then bring these sounds back into the studio and start working with them to picture. And I found that whole process to be so magical, where you're sort of creating more than the sum of its parts, you know, when you start putting sound to picture for the first time.
Yeah.
And then I sort of started doing more sound effects editing. Some of the highlights for me after Terminator 2 were Titanic, and then right after Titanic, Saving Private Ryan, which I again, Gary Rydstrom was the sound designer on, and I worked under him as sort of the lead sound effects editor. And then soon after that, I got the opportunity to move to New Zealand for a few years to be one of the supervising sound editors on the Lord of the Rings films, the trilogy with Peter Jackson. And that was a really incredible experience that really shaped a lot of my thinking and my work. And then after that, I came back to California and got offered the first Transformers film, and then hooked up with Eric on that project. And that proved to be such an incredible collaboration creatively that we just decided we got to keep this going. And so we started our company E Squared, and we've been doing a lot of diverse projects together since then.
Yeah, I mean, the projects you've worked on, like you say, Transformers, Argo, you did, didn't you?
That's right.
Godzilla, the Kung Fu Panda movies. I mean, you know, don't get much more diverse than three projects like that.
One of the cool things is about doing this type of work is being able to do very different projects, and so life never gets boring.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I love about it.
Variety is the spice of life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally. So the latest thing you've been working on is A Quiet Place, which has been getting amazing reviews and hugely popular all over the place. So, I mean, you're asked, do you want to do a movie called The Quiet Place? Is your first reaction, this will be easy, it's going to be quiet? or did you sort of get the script and go, ah, okay.
No, it's a funny thing is you'd think a movie that's called A Quiet Place would be easy, but the opposite is true.
I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, a typical movie has, you know, that's full of sound or might be bombastic, might have a lot of music score wall to wall, in a way is might even be simpler, because you've got a little bit, you know, you've got a bit of a security blanket with so much going on. And, you know, especially when there's score going as well.
Yeah.
There's just this sort of like warm bath of, you know, cloaking everything. And a film like A Quiet Place, where it's intentionally so sparse, which is a critical story point too, you know, sound is deadly. Sound is an issue of survival. Mm. So every little sound could be the potential for death. So it's actually a lot harder. You're naked, and little sounds become big sounds. And much of the challenge is how to create that negative space and what you subtract and what you choose not to play.
Yeah, there's some really interesting things you did on the film as well. You've got a lot of unique stuff with like going inside the sort of sound of the characters' heads. Particularly, you've got there's a deaf character who's actually played by a deaf actress in the film as well, isn't it? So how did you come up with that idea, and how did you approach it?
Well, you know, when we started working on the movie, one of the first scenes we started working on was really the opening of the movie through the sort of attack that happened, the first attack that happens. Mm. The first thing we were trying to do is just establish the sonic logic of the environment, all the environmental sounds, and the whole idea that there's no living things left that are loud or that stand out in any way from the background, because they would have all been killed. And so just trying to basically set up the rules of the film, really, to live by for the rest of the film. And then as we started doing that, we realized, this character is deaf. And part of what we want to do is really suck the audience in to this experience and have the audience really be active participants in this story. And we realized, what we really need to do is go inside the perspective of some of these characters whenever we can. And having a deaf character, like, what a perfect way to get into this experience. So in the scene as the family's walking to the bridge, there was a scene where we go close to Regan right before this attack starts. Regan, the deaf daughter, and we're like, okay, we need to really, this is a place to go inside and experience the world that she's experiencing. And then when we're there and she sees the fear that's on her dad's face as he hears this loud sound being made, it's going to be this interesting contrast between perceiving the world as she perceives it and not hearing anything, and then seeing this incredible fear on her dad's face. And what would it be like to experience this moment that way? And so we experimented with that and felt it was really powerful. And then that it sort of grew from there, where we worked backwards into the pharmacy, really realizing we need to establish this idea of going into what John came to call her sonic envelope.
Right.
And we need to set this up earlier at the beginning of the movie. So at that point, John was incredibly into the whole idea, to the point where in pickup shoots, they went in, like, got more close-ups of her ear with the cochlear implant to give us a place to go into her sonic envelope and set up this whole idea of a sonic, perspective for her. And then we realized, well, we need to do this with the creature as well, because it's blind and everything for it is based around its incredibly acute hearing. So we need to experience that. And then, lastly, it's like the envelope of all the hearing characters.
Yeah.
What is their experience of the world? And that becomes, in many ways, the experience of the audience, and helps suck the audience into this whole world.
It's a really clever trick, and works superbly well. So how are you putting those sounds together? Where are you finding those sounds? Is everything pretty much recorded fresh, or are you using stuff that you've kind of collected over the years, or is it coming from libraries? How are you putting all the sounds together?
Yeah, it's all basically all of the sounds are either sounds that we record fresh for the movie, or else things that we've pretty recently recorded and have that, haven't used in something else, but just have as part of our personal recording libraries. We do a lot of recording with, some of the cool tools that we're able to use are some newer microphones that allow us to do some pretty fun things in unusual ways, and these are recordings that we kind of have to do ourselves because they don't exist in any libraries.
Right. Yeah. Do you find yourself kind of wandering down the street one day and hear something and think that'd be really useful, and end up sort of whipping a recorder out to record stuff?
Totally. Yeah. No, we have our rigs with us kind of everywhere. In fact, fortunately, my wife is very understanding. My recording rig came with us on our honeymoon, and I think the thing that makes me find so much joy in that too is that it allows us to pay more attention to reality. I think I think what can kind of sometimes happen is for any given person, you can start to tune out reality and really start to only focus on what's right in front of your nose at any moment. And the act of recording is, in a sense, kind of a meditation, and it kind of forces you to experience reality in a heightened way. And after having done this for a few years, it's you listen in a different way. It's a different type of awareness. So all the time we, you know, there might be a bus going by that has just a weird air brake, and you go, okay, I need to wait here at the same time tomorrow and record that.
The interesting thing I find too is like some of the feedback we're getting on the movie is I feel like, you know, people are starting to are getting some of that same experience that Eric has just described that we get when we go out recording, where we really are forced to listen in a really fresh way, really open our ears up. And some of the feedback we've been getting on the experience of watching the film reminds me of that experience, where people are really being forced to open their ears in a fresh way and really hear things the way they've never heard them before. And it's really just about listening.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to hear stories from people saying they were afraid to eat popcorn dinner, and you know, in a way, making themselves an active participant in the story, in the scenes, and relating to the characters in a really interesting kind of way, and that's kind of fun, like making an audience like collectively hold their breath, hang on to every little sound, and we don't really let them go until the ending credits.
See, sound designer's revenge on the noisy cinema goer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like, yeah, force people to shut up and listen.
Yeah. Absolutely. How was working with John? Because I mean, he's well known as an actor, but not so. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's directed a couple of little things, and he directed some of The Office, but yeah, this is by far the biggest thing.
Amazing. Yeah, he was amazing. Like, so fearless in terms of like trying some of these kind of bold and unconventional things that we tried to do in the movie, in terms of getting as quiet as we did to the point of total silence, you know, digital zero, which is kind of unheard of in movies. And he was like so like fearless about going into these kind of bold new territory in a way that it was really just a joy to work with him. And he's just also so enthusiastic, you know, and has so many ideas and is so creative, like really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the very first time we met him, so we'd worked with the producers before, and they asked us to come in and meet with John and see if we'd be a good fit. And of course, you know, reading the script, we're like, oh man, this is going to be awesome. And this will be a dream. And before we could say anything, John was like, this is a sound designer's dream. Oh, okay, great. You get it. Awesome.
Yeah.
And he just encouraged the whole team to just go for it. And John has an incredible ear, really amazing. There was one point during the final mix where he was hearing something that no one else on the stage could hear. And there was one little tiny automation bump in volume within one of the several dozen music stems going on. And he could hear that tiny little bump. And it was kind of amazing, because the rest of us, we're all professionals, that we do sound for a living. We have very finely tuned ears, but he showed us that, man, he's got golden ears. We actually said, hey, if the directing thing doesn't work out for you, why don't you come work for us? Because we're really good with sound.
Yeah. You mentioned the music there. There is music as well in the film. It's from Marco. I mean, how was it working with him on that? Because didn't you end up removing some of his score from the project as well?
Ethan was describing the opening scenes where we shift into the daughter's cochlear implant sonic point of view. And originally there was music through that section, which made it kind of impossible to register those shifts of perspective. So that was kind of the first place where
you know, we realized we need to strip away and music in particular in order to clarify that.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting because when we first started working on the movie, it was just a very early cut. And because there really wasn't much sound design at that point, there was temp music everywhere. So right. First thing we did really is start, and it wasn't, I think most of it wasn't Marco's music. Some of it might have been demos from him. But the very first thing we did is started like removing a lot of music just because like Eric's just described, in order to tell some of the story sonically, we just felt it was necessary to really strip it down, including the music or even mostly the music. And then, you know, as Marco's music started to come in, there were various places that it had to come back out in order to let some of these moments really just, you know, read sonically.
Yeah.
But then what it also allowed is for the music, when it did play, to really have a bigger impact because it wasn't wall to wall anymore.
Yeah.
So it really had, you know, gravitas when we did use it. It was very specific and very, very intentional.
Yeah. And Marco is just not only incredibly gracious and willing to try anything, but also just the consummate storyteller. Like he sees the big picture and gets it.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of telling the emotional story of the family, you know, we couldn't have had a better partner in working on this film. Like Ethan and I have been fortunate. We worked with him a few times. My first time was on iRobot, which he scored.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then more recently we did World War Z and The Shallows.
Yeah.
So it's just such a pleasure working with Marco.
I'm glad he wasn't like overly upset about you removing his music. I imagine him wandering away, muttering under his breath about you might have decided to do this before I wrote all this score.
Well, that's the thing. We did do it. We did do it before you wrote it.
That's good.
But then it, you know, things happen so quickly that.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, it works for the film, and that's the important thing, isn't it? So.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Right. You gotta always keep the big picture in mind, you know?
Yeah.
Like what's really serving the story at any given point in time, any moment. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of last questions for you. They're kind of TV related because we cover a lot of TV shows on the site. I know you guys mainly do film, but we always ask these to people. So the first question would be, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
Well, let's see. I'm excited for the next season of Westworld to...
Yes.
This Sunday is coming back. That'll be very fun. I've been watching the effect series Trust about the J. Paul Getty family.
Oh, yeah. We're getting that soon. I'm looking forward to that.
It's really good. I just started watching it last night. It's really, really well done.
Yeah. And then we also like Rick and Morty at home, my wife and I.
Oh, I love Rick and Morty.
I've been watching Homeland, which I've been followed. I guess this is the final season.
One more after this.
Okay. Anyways, I've loved that series since the beginning.
Yeah.
What else? I started watching Trust last night, which is phenomenal.
Good.
And I recently did a binge catch up on Game of Thrones because I hadn't been able to watch the last season when it was actually on. And so I did a like 2-night binge to get caught up there, which is always awesome.
Yeah. I'm so looking forward to I'm sad, but I'm looking forward to the final season of that. It's going to be amazing next year. And the last question would be, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or future, which show would it be?
Oh, past, present, or future. You know what? Maybe this answer might change if you ask me again tomorrow, but... my favorite TV show growing up was Twin Peaks. So I think that tied with perhaps Patrick McGowan's The Prisoner. It might be one of those.
Good choice.
And what about you, Ethan?
That's funny. I'm struggling. All I can think of is I Love Lucy.
dialogue editing in that one.
I don't know why. Maybe that's this is my youngest TV watching memories. So they've like the most deeply ingrained in my reptilian brain.
Maybe. Well, you know, she was amazing. First female studio head in the 50s. I mean, you know, what more can she was brilliant. So I'm a huge fan of Lucy. So awesome. Well, thank you for spending a bit of time to talk through your work. It's been a real pleasure having you on. Hopefully we'll get you back on again when your next project comes up.
We'd love that. It's been a pleasure.
I will talk to you again soon, hopefully.
All right. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Okay. Bye. Okay. Bye-bye.
So that was the interview with Ethan and Eric. Hope you really enjoyed that. Quiet Place is out in cinemas right now. Here's some highlights for next week on TV. So, few highlights for next week. First up, if you've not had enough of horror yet, there is The Terror, which comes to AMC Global on the 24th of April at 9 p.m. That's the Ridley Scott TV show about the Royal Navy's perilous passage into uncharted territory as the crew attempts to discover the Northwest Passage. If you haven't got AMC, they're also doing something quite interesting because AMC comes as part of the BT Sports package. So if you haven't got that, you won't have AMC on Sky. But as a promotional thing, they are putting it on YouTube. They're putting the first episode on YouTube for 24 hours on the 24th from midnight. So if you want to see the first episode but don't have AMC Global, go to youtube.com/BT from 1 minute past midnight on Tuesday the 24th of April. You can watch the first episode anywhere in the UK for free. So go and keep an eye out for that if you want to see what the show is like. Next up, we have Barry, which is a new show starring Bill Hader as an ex-Marine who turns into a low-rent hitman in the Midwest. It's also got Henry Winkler in it. It looks like a very, very funny show. That's coming to Sky Atlantic on the 26th of April at 10:45. We've got one show I've been desperately waiting for, which is called Happy, and that follows the story of a corrupt, intoxicated ex-cop turned hitman who's injured when a hit goes bad, only to have his life changed forever by a relentlessly positive imaginary blue-winged horse named Happy, voiced by Patton Oswalt. Really, what more do you need in a TV show? That is coming to Netflix from the 26th of April, and I urge you to go watch that. It looks hilarious. Also on Netflix on the 27th, The New Legends of Monkey, which is a new revamped version of the old Monkey TV series. It's actually not technically a remake because there are various shows that have been made based on the novel A Journey to the West. This is just a new iteration. But for those of you that watched the old Monkey TV show, I'm sure you'll want to go and check it out. That's The New Legends of Monkey. That's on Netflix from the 27th of April. You've got Superstition also coming to Netflix. That's on the 29th of April. This is a supernatural drama about the Hastings family who own a funeral home in the mysterious town of La Rochelle, Georgia. Stars Mario Van Peebles. Don't know any more about it than that, but it's called Superstition. That's coming to Netflix on the 29th of April. Superstore Season 3. That's coming to ITV2 on the 30th of April at 8:30. Stars America Ferrera and Ben Feldman. It's basically a workplace comedy about a family of employees that work in a supersized megastore. First two seasons went out fairly quickly because we're running behind. I think we've about caught up with the US now. Season 3 of Superstore comes on the 30th of April at 8:30. And then, as we were talking about earlier, Slasher Guilty Party, Season 2 of that comes to Pick TV on Tuesday the 1st of May at 10 p.m. Go and watch that. I've seen the first episode. If you like your sort of gory slasher teen horrors, well worth going to watch. It's great fun, so go and see that. And that's everything for this week. We will be back with a full show next week. If you want to find us in the meantime, obviously go to geektown.co.uk to get all the latest air date information and TV news. We're posting throughout the week and things are changing quite rapidly. We're coming up to Upfronts, which is the time in May when all the renewals and cancellations come in, so you keep an eye on the site for that. If you want to get in touch with the podcast with your questions or comments, email podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram at geektownuk. That's everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.